All right, so let's start. So, hi everyone. My name is Olivier Grisel. I'm a software engineer at INRIA and a core contributor to the scikit-learn project. And I'm gonna be joined afterwards, hopefully, by a team head who is in the train right now to teach this tutorial on scikit-learn and machine learning in Python. So for today, I will give a couple of a refresher on the main machine learning concept on the slides. Then I will introduce the scikit-learn project as a software open source project. And then we will have the hands-on workshop in an interactive Jupyter notebook. And so we'll do predictive modeling on census data, survey data on the American population. And we will use Pandas and scikit-learn mostly to do that. And there is another part of this notebook on a parameter tuning using scikit-optimize and also scikit-learn components. And if we have time, we have additional exercises, but I think that's going to be enough for today. So what is machine learning or what is predictive modeling? The goal of machine learning is to make predictions of the outcome of some physical phenomenon or social phenomenon based on the data that we collect. And the goal is to make prediction on what's going to happen in the future on stuff that we cannot observe yet or we haven't observed yet. And we do that not by hard coding the rules of the behavior of the system in the code of the program, but by writing a program that will extract the structure of historical data by itself and generate another program, basically, that can make predictions based on the historical data. And the mathematical tools that we use for that are traditional statistical tools, and it basically try to summarize the structure of the training data and make that summary executable somehow as a predictive model. And so you can see that machine learning is an alternative to hard-coded rules written by experts that know about the phenomenon. If you don't know the underlying rule that generated the data, you can try to guess them using a statistical tool. And sometimes you see that this is conflicting with hard-coded written rules by experts. But in many cases, we use machine learning in situations where we cannot write those rules because we don't know, or we cannot ask experts to make recommendations very quickly, for instance. If you write a recommender system for a retail website, you cannot ask experts to make a personalized recommendation to all of your millions of users because it will be much too costly. So I think machine learning is useful in that setting where you need to make many small predictions that have the impact of this prediction is not too if you make a mistake is not a big problem, but on aggregate, if you make good predictions or better than chance, it can be useful. So it's a bit abstract. I will give examples later. So the first example of machine learning, for instance, is to use the historical data of a real estate agency where past customers described the assets that they sold in that agency. So for instance, you have the type of housing, apartment, house, duplex, whatever. The number of rooms, which is an integer, whereas the type is a category. The surface is square meters, whether or not it's close to public transportation, as a Boolean flag, for instance. So you have different descriptors of the records, and they can have heterogeneous types. And there is one specific column in that database that has the value of a variable that we are really interested in, which is the price of the transaction. So those are past events, so we have the price for those. But if a new customer arrives in the agency, just before that, so the in the machine learning vocabulary, or at least in the scikit-learn vocabulary, we describe this data according to those names. Like the records in that database are the samples, because they are sampled from a fixed distribution. This is the hypothesis that we make. The columns or the descriptors are called features, and the variable that we are trying to predict is called the target variable, target column or whatever. And so if you have new customers that go into that agency and describe their assets, they ask the real estate agent for an estimation of the price they could possibly sell their housing. And so either you ask the real estate agent, and because by habits they know about the stuff, they will do a good guess. Otherwise, what you can do, if you don't have access to an expert, is to try to find a statistical summary that relates the target variable to the features based on the past data, and to apply it to fill in the question marks. So we can write that as a data flow. So you start on the right-hand side from the historical data, and that data can be of very different kinds of formats, in very different kinds of formats. For instance, it could be text documents, images, sound recordings, or transactions in a database. And there is one specific attribute or column, which we call the labels, which is the target variable, that we're interested in predicting. So for instance, for images, it could be the class of the main object in the image, or whether or not this image should be moderated out of the website or not, or something like this. And for sounds and images, typically you have to collect human annotation on the data. Whereas for transactions, if it's an automated process and you want to detect frauder, for instance, in activity, you can collect historical fraud events, and you use that transaction of past events to make prediction on the future. And in that case, the annotation can be semi-automated. So the first thing that we need to do is to format the data into some numerical representation that we call feature vectors. Each image or each text document or each sound is going to be translated into a one-dimensional numerical array, an NumPy array, for instance, that describes the interesting parts of that record. And so if you batch a bunch of records together, you have a 2D array, two-dimensional array, which is the training set. And so you give that two-dimensional array of input data plus the labels for each of those records to a machine learning algorithm, and there are many of them, but most of them will accept this as long as the data is formatted syntactically this way. It's gonna run. Maybe it's gonna output something useless, but it's gonna run. And what the output of this machine learning algorithm is the model. And in the future, you can reuse that model, you can deploy it on a separate machine, for instance, and accept new data. You need to extract features the same way that you did for the training set, and pass that feature vector to the model, and the model will predict the expected label, and sometimes it can also predict some confidence level. So there are many applications of machine learning. Those are people using scikit-learn to build applications. So for instance, the New York Times is using statistical models to model the virality and the readers' engagement on their website. Airbnb is using a lot of machine learning, but among other things, they do fraud detection or price hinting. Spotify uses machine learning for personalized radios playlists based on past user habits. Birchbox is doing inventory forecasting and trend detections for fashion items. Caterpillar is putting sensors in their machines, in their vehicles, and they collect operation data from the vehicles to do predictive maintenance, so to build the statistical models of normal operating device. And as soon as they detect new stuff that were not that are unlikely according to the statistical model. Maybe it's because something is going to break. So you can plan ahead in the future, maintenance effort. And you can also, on dating website like OkCupid, do personality matching, or basically it's a recommender system. So there are many applications, and those are business applications that at EuroSciPy, I think you're more interested in science, and you know probably already that there are many applications of machine learning in science to analyze data, to filter it, to remove background noise, and so on. So scikit-learn is a library of machine learning algorithms, and we try to focus on established methods. There is a book which is called Elements of Statistical Learning, the second edition, and it's available for free as a PDF online. And basically, those are the kind of statistical methods that we implement in scikit-learn. And we don't necessarily implement the latest research paper, because we want to wait a bit to make sure that it's actually useful to other people than the initial researcher that wrote the paper. It's maintained as an open source project under the BSD license, so you can use for whatever you want. And the main feature of scikit-learn is we try to provide a homogeneous API for all of those statistical models. So most of the models, all of the models, we have at least a fit method to fit the data to train the model. And then they can either have a predict or transform method to either make predictions or to transform the data into a new vector space. It's written in Python using NumPy and SciPy for the vector processing and optimization. And sometimes some of the models, they don't benefit from efficient array operation, and they need nested for loops, for instance. And in that case, we use Cython to compile the performance bottleneck of the algorithm, basically. But most of the code is written in Python. We also provide a bunch of additional tools, like tools to evaluate the quality, the accuracy of models, of trained models, and how to tune to select the best models, and how to tune the parameters, and how to build ensembles of a group of models to make an ensemble model that performs better than the individual component. So in practice, if we take the data flow and we reshape it from top to bottom, from training data to predictions, and in practice, the Python APIs looks this way. So we start by creating a model, instantiating a class with, for instance, logistic regression, which is a classifier in scikit-learn. And then we need to make sure that we have the training data formatted as a 2D array for the input features, which is called X-train. And the output labels should be a 1D array. Most of the time it's 1D. Y-train, which could be integers or real numbers. If it's integers, it's interpreted as categories. If it's real numbers, it's interpreted as a continuous variable, like trying to predict the temperature, for instance. So the first, with integers, this is a classification problem. With the continuous variable, which is called, we name the machine learning problem a regression problem. But it's basically supervised machine learning anyway. Once we have, at the end of the call to fit, the model is modified in place. The model object is modified, and you can reuse it to make prediction. And you cannot make prediction without calling fit before. And so basically you call the predict method on a 2D array X test, which is the new data, and you will get as an output a 1D array of predictions that has the same kind of type as X train. And then if you have access to the true labels for the test data, you can evaluate the quality of the model using a scoring function. For instance, you can compute the accuracy if it's a classification problem like this. The accuracy is just the number of times we make a correct prediction. We have the good category, the average number of times we have the good category. And so just, I don't know if I have jokes. Yes. No. Yes. Okay. So just to explain something that why do we use X and Y as variable for the data is that X and Y are traditionally used in mathematics. If you have a function, the input is X and the output is Y, basically. And basically here, we are not trying to compute the output for a given X and a given F. We are given X and Y, and we try to build a Python program that will relate the two. And the output of the machine learning algorithm is F, basically. So, but this is why we use X and Y. When you do the mathematical description of those models, it's natural to use X and Y. All right, so there are many algorithms in scikit-learn. I won't explain in details what they mean from a mathematical point of view, just how to use them. And then you will have to look at the documentation and to read the literature. We give the reference to the main papers in the API documentation. And so I will just introduce some of the most useful, the most used. So for instance, support vector machines with a RBF kernel, which is a nonlinear model that is quite powerful on medium data. On large data, it's probably useless. But if you have less than 1,000 records or a couple of thousand records, I think it's good to try this one. So you just imported the SVC class from sklearn SVM, and you instantiate the model and you give the hyperparameter of the model. So those are models that parameters that the user needs to set in advance, and they will control the behavior of the learning algorithm. And we will explain later how to find that automatically from the data. And so once you have built the model, they can do fit, predict, and compute the accuracy or the F1 score, which is another performance metric for classification. And the bottom of this workflow is always the same. If you want to train a new kind of model, you can just change the first two lines, the import line and the line that defines the model structure. So for instance, if you want to choose to use a linear classifier instead of a nonlinear support vector machine, you can import from the linear model package SGD classifier, which is a linear model trained with stochastic gradient descent. And it has different parameters, hyperparameters, but the API is the same. And if you want to try random forest, for instance, you just pick up the random forest and you can give the number of trees you want in your forest and so on. So there are many algorithms in scikit-learn. It's a bit too small to read, but here I give the output of the prediction of different algorithms in columns. And they have been trained on different problems as rows. And so those are all binary classification problems. You have to classify whether a dot is going to be blue or red based on the location on a 2D plane. So it's a completely toy problem, but it highlights the fact that they have very different performance behaviors based on the statistical assumption they make on the structure of the data. And so, for instance, the first row, you have two blobs of data, the blue blob and the red blobs, and they are basically half moons that overlap a bit like this. So there is no linear separation boundary between the two groups. You have to find a wobbly decision function, basically. And you can see that the linear model, like those two columns, LDA here, linear discriminant analysis, and linear SVMs, they are linear models, and logistic regression would be the same. They can only find a decision boundary which is a hyperplane in the space of features. So in a 2D space, it's just a straight line. And in that case, the performance, it's written, it's small, it's 80% for the first one, so it's not very good. Whereas the first one, nearest neighbors, is able to find the structure. And if you look at, for instance, RBF SVM, this column, it's quite good at finding a smooth decision functions that follow the shape of the data. For this data, I think it's the best in this case. And the second row is just blue dots in the middle, and they are surrounded by red dots on the other side. And here again, the linear models are very bad. But then on the noisy data, the last one is just two blobs with overlapping data points. Sorry, the team is calling. Hey, I'm doing the tutorial right now. Where are you? Ah, yes. yes, it's not the same location as last year. It's the, I think you should look up on Google Map and on the venue. You have the Google Map link on the website. And I don't have internet. Let me, it's not exactly nearby. It's like a 40 minute walk. So. I can give you the address exactly, and then you have to ask people. So it's Stauttstrasse 5. Staudt, Staudt Strasse 5. And so, yeah. So it's the it's also the same Friedrich Alexander University Erlangen, but it's the physics department basically. All right. Okay. See you in a while. All right. So yes. Yes, the slides, they are available on speakerdeck/ogrizzle. And it's the first one, intro to scikit-learn. So, speakerdeck.com/ogrizzle. Ogrizzle. Okay. All right. So the last row, the data sets is basically two Gaussian blobs, random blobs of points, but they are overlapping just by chance. And so in that case, the input data is very noisy, and a linear model is basically doing what best you can do. And more complex models with nonlinear boundaries, they are not going to perform better, but they can even perform worse because they could memorize the noise, whereas the linear models is too constrained to memorize the noise and will make a better generalization. We have a better generalization behavior, basically. So there is no, depending on the structure and of the data and the statistical assumption of the model, it really depends which one is the best. There are some models that tend to perform better than others on average. For instance, gradient boosting regression trees are very often competitive in machine learning competitions. And if you deal with images or sounds or this kind of signal data, then convolutional neural networks tend to perform very good and the best. But when you have high dimensional data and few number of samples, then linear models tend to perform the best. It's not a guarantee that you can guess which one is the best ahead of time. So the best way is to try and measure the accuracy and see how they generalize. And I will explain later how to do that. Yes? So the RBF model for those three small data sets in two dimensions that are completely fake and don't reflect the reality, in this case, the SVM RBF model is the best. But if you have high dimensional data, if the features are not on the same scale, they have here it's a geometric problem, and the RBF function is basically good. If you have different features that are prices in dollars and I don't know, temperatures in Celsius degrees and something like that as input descriptor for your classification problem, then the RBF function, I'm not sure, is going to be good. And typically, decision trees are better in that case. So, yeah, you have to try. And also, another limitation of SVM RBF is that the computational performance behavior is very weird. It means that when your training size data is growing, the model becomes untractable to train, because the training algorithm has more than quadratic complexity, time complexity, with respect to the number of training samples. Whereas, for instance, a decision tree or a neural network, they do not have this problem. So the RBF SVM function model is good for medium-sized data sets. So to learn more about the different kinds of algorithms that we have in scikit-learn, you can go to the website scikit-learn.org, and they are organized. The documentation is organized with the main groups. So for supervised learning, we have classification and regression, and you see examples of algorithms, but you have the full list on the website. And we have also tools for unsupervised modeling that I won't introduce during this tutorial. But for instance, if you want to do clustering, like in this case, you don't have a Y and you don't try to predict a Y. You try to predict groups of data based on the geometric structure of the data, like customer profiles, for instance. So you can use clustering algorithms. And there are also dimensionality reduction algorithms, where you have data in a large dimensional space with many descriptors, and you want to visualize it in 2D, for instance. You want to visualize the statistical distribution and repartition of the data in a 2D space. Then you can use principal component analysis or T-stochastic neighbors embedding, TSNE, as a visualization algorithm. And basically what they do is a dimensionality reduction operation that tries to preserve most of the structure of the data and give you some insight. And those dimensionality reduction models, they can also be used as the pre-processing step for a classification or a regression problem, for instance, or even a clustering problem. So sometimes it's possible to do a pipeline of different models. And typically dimensionality reduction models, they are transformers, where the others are classifiers or regressors. And there are also tools for pre-processing. And in that case, you have also transformer models with a transform method. Okay, I will explain that in more detail in the workshop. So I hope that by now you had a chance to get the tutorial material. If not, you can download it from there. So those are IPython notebook, Jupyter notebook. And so to install Jupyter, scikit-learn, pandas, matplotlib, you should use Anaconda, I think is the easiest way, or nowadays Pips works on most platforms as well. You can start Jupyter. So if you have not started it yet in the past, it depends on the platform, but on all platforms you have a terminal on Linux, Mac, and Windows. So find a way to use the command line in your operating system. And then if you have installed Jupyter, Anaconda, you should have Jupyter somewhere in your path, and you should be able to do a Jupyter notebook. Making that bigger. What? So for the Wi-Fi, there is only Eduroam, and Eduroam is only available for academics who have their own password in their home institution that should work here. Okay, so the new hotspot is being set up right now, and they should give us the vouchers at lunchtime. So if you really need internet, if you need the Anaconda, there should be two USB keys. Okay, there is one there. Okay. Does someone else need Anaconda? No. Yeah. Yeah, the tutorial is also on the key. So on the key, you have a zip file with the GitHub repository with the notebook for today. So. Once you have installed Anaconda, you should have Jupyter in your path. In my case, I'm using a virtual environment, so I will just deactivate it. This you don't need to do it if you activate EuroCyper. We'll use the same. Okay, just setting my environment to have the correct version. So if you start Jupyter Notebook this way, it should pop up a browser window, and then you should see the file, the folder structure of your operating system, and just pick up a folder or create a new one, and unzip or git clone the notebook into that folder from outside, and it should show up here, and then you go into that folder. So in that case, I have it under code, and EuroSciPy, I think. Too much code. Yeah, this one. So, and once you found the folder with the notebooks, you should have this view, basically. So there are three notebooks, a data set, and a folder with solutions. Ah, okay. Where is the second USB key? Can you bring it back to the first row, please? For people. Ah, okay, once you're ready. Okay. All right, so we will start with the first one. So if you click it, it should open. I have already opened it here. And I just removed the first row and made it bigger, but this is the only change. Okay. So we will use for this session, for the first part of this session, we will use Matplotlib for visualization, NumPy as the array data structure for vector operations, for the data management, basically, and Pandas as a library. There will be a tutorial, or maybe there is. And I think the beginner's tutorial for Pandas is tomorrow. As a library for manipulation of heterogeneous data, like data with different columns with different types, and so we will use that for as a preprocessing tool for scikit-learn, basically. So the data is included. So you need to execute all of those cells, and if you want to if you don't want to see the output before executing the cell, it's good to go to cell all output clear, and that will clear everything. So we need to execute all of the cells, because if you miss one, then you will have undefined variables and weird error messages. To execute a cell, you can press Shift Enter on the cell, and you should see a number execution number increment on the cell itself, and then the cursor is moving on to the next one. I hope you already had the opportunity to play a bit with Jupyter, but if not, just a quick intro. You should have a list of keyboard shortcuts here that are very useful in help. And in particular, you should be able to use Ctrl+M+A, for instance, to insert a cell above, and Ctrl+M+B to insert a new cell below. And then you can do stuff here. So the cell has two states, the blue state and the green state. I don't remember the names, command and I don't know. When you can press enter to go into the green state, and then you can do a Python code there and execute it. For instance, Shift Enter, and you get it. And then you can press enter again over it, and then you get the cursor and edit it again and modify it and re-execute it, and you get the new result. Okay. And if you want to execute the same cell several times without moving, you can use Control Enter, which is quite useful if you have a random process, for instance, and you want to see random output. This way. Okay. So we can just skip this one, and then we will load the data. So this cell is useless because the data is already loaded in the local folder. But if you don't have the adult.data file, you could fetch it from the website using this. And then we will use pandas. So this file, adult data, is a CSV file, which is a survey of the American population, the census data from 20 or 30 years old. I don't know exactly. But the problem with this CSV file is that you don't have the name of the columns. So we need to specify the names of the columns manually. So we can do that using pandas.readcsv. And then we have a data object, which is basically a pandas data frame. And you can see the content of the CSV file that has been loaded in a Python object data. And so, in that table, you have records that have numbers, so 0, 1, 2. But the actual data has columns with names, like age, work class, FNL, WDT, which means final weight. This column, we will just ignore it. It's a weighting mechanism for people who are doing census. I don't know exactly what the statistical meaning of that, so I decided to discard it completely. And it actually, this is what is done on the next cell here. We will ignore it for this tutorial. If you really want to do census analysis, you should read the documentation and try to get a statistical understanding on what it means. But we don't need it to teach machine learning today. And then you have, so who needs the key again? No, it's fine. Okay. So we have additional attributes, and they have different types. For instance, age is a number, work class is a category, so it could be a kind of work, is public, state of government, or private. Then you have the kinds of education, the type of education, bachelor degree, HS, I don't know what it is, 11th grade, whatever. And then the number of years of education for that person, the marital status, the occupation. So they are adults. They are all 16 years old or more. Whether or not they are in a marital relationship, the race, because it's US data, so they do that. And the sex, the gender of the person. And actually there are even more than this. They have additional, financial data, like capital gain and capital loss, I think, over the last year, I'm not sure. And the number of hours worked per week, and the country of origin. And so this category has 49, I think, possible values, so many possible categories. And finally, there is the last column, which is the income, whether or not the person has over $50,000 income per year. And the goal of this data set, or at least we are going to use this data set to try to build a predictive model that predicts the income of a person based on all the other descriptors. So I said that we will ignore the final weight column, so we can just drop it like this. Don't forget to execute the cells, otherwise we'll have different behaviors. So we can have a look at standard pandas functions methods. And so we can see that all the data set has no missing values because all the features have the same number of non-missing values. And they are 32,000 entries, basically. So it's a medium-sized data set. It's small, but it's not very small, but it's good enough for machine learning, basically. If you just have 100 samples, do not do machine learning on that. you really need more records than this. So we can use data.describe to see additional statistics on the numerical features of the data set. You can see that the categorical columns, they disappeared. But for the numerical columns, we have additional data, like the average age in the data set, the median age, the maximum age, and the lowest 17 and 90, and the number of years, and so on. And in particular, nobody needed it. Okay. The hours per week, you can see that in the US, many people tend to work 40 hours per week. I think there is some regulatory constraint, or I don't know. So we can also use pandas to do aggregations and to do more involved analytics, descriptive analytics. For instance, we can group the data by occupation, which is a categorical variable, and then count the number of records in each group for each occupation and sort the results by occupation and take the 10 largest. And so here we can see that for the occupation column, many have prof specialty. I don't know what it means. Professor specialty or exec managerial sales. What? And we can also make more advanced things with Panda. We can do the same group by operation. But in each group, this time, we will apply this Python function, which is a lambda expression, that will compute the mean of the income on each group by each occupation. So I'm using NumPy mean, the average, and then I will sort the values of the groups by average, the average number of person that has an income that is larger than 50K. And this way we can see how the occupations impact the ability of people to have a high income. And you can see that a very low fraction of people doing private house services, they have almost none of them as a yearly income higher than 50K. Whereas if you do management, or you are a professor, I guess, I'm not sure what it is, or maybe professional specialty, I don't know. If you're a specialist on something very specific, you have a higher chance to have a large yearly income. So just by doing this, we can actually guess the income. We can build rules by ourselves to try to guess the income. So we will try to find ways to transform those variables to make it easy for the machine learning algorithms to do that. So we can have a look at the country of origin. You can see that most people come from the United States and then Mexico, Philippines, and so on. You can check the distribution of the number of years of education. So Pandas data frame, they have plotting functions built in, and a histogram is one of them, hist. So you can just specify the columns you are interested in and the number of bins, and you can see the 1D distribution of that specific column. We can do the same for age, and you can see that it's a very different distribution. And horse per week. And you can see there is a large peak at 40 horse per week, and then people working part-time and people working more than full-time, almost 100 hours per week. And what we can also do is a scatter plot using the plot function of pandas, using the kind scatter, to compare two attributes, to see the distribution of the data over two axes, so age and hours per week, for instance. And here you can see that we have a nonlinear distribution that relates the two. It's not a linear correlation. And you can explain this distribution by saying that, for instance, when you are young, less than 20 years old, you have a higher likelihood to be a student and to work part-time and to be student part-time the rest of the time. Whereas when you are middle-aged, you have a higher likelihood to find a full-time job. And when you're older, after 60, some people continue to work, but they tend to do that part-time. And we can specifically have a look at the income distribution. And if we group by income, you can see that there are only two income levels in that distribution, over and under 50K. And you can see that most of the people in this data set are under 50K, and only about a third is above. And we can actually compute the exact fraction using NumPy mean and a Boolean operator on that column. It's actually not a third, it's a quarter, 25%, 24. So for machine learning, for later to explain the behavior of the model, it's good to extract the two possible names of the target variable, because they are strings, and we just store them in an array called target names, and then we will use that later. Now that we have the two groups, what we can do is a combined histogram using PLT hist two times in the cell notebook cell for the two groups of data, low income and high income. And you can see that low income is just the data frame that has been filtered out using this mask expression in Pandas. So it's a Boolean expression that will filter out the records based on whether or not this condition is true on the income column. And so we have two separate Pandas data frame, and we can plot the two data frames on the same figure using Matplotlib. And we can see that when you are younger, you're working part-time, many people are working part-time, and you have higher likelihood to have a low income. And then a large fraction of middle-aged people tend to have a high income, or a larger fraction. And then that decreases slowly in Tillion. Okay, so let's do an exercise. So let's reuse those two Pandas data frame, low income and high income. But instead of doing this 1D plot, let's do the same 2D scatter plot with age and hours per week, but with the two groups overlapped. So let's try to do that, and you can have a look at the other, this as an example, and this as an example, and try to combine the two examples in this cell to do this plot. And then try to draw some conclusions on what's inside the data. I forgot to tell at the beginning that there will be a coffee break at 10:30. Has anybody managed to do it? Yep. Yes, 1, 2. Give you 1 minute more. All right, so you can leave the cell in the state where it is, and in the bottom cell there is a way to load the solution, so you can just uncomment this line and execute it, and it will basically load the content of this file into the cell, and then you can execute the cell again. So here we do two scatter plots overlapped, and because we use opacity level that is less than one, we can see the overlap. You can also control the size of the dots using 50. So this is a really hacky way to plot a density map. There are better libraries to do that in the Python ecosystem. But if you want to do it quickly with matplotlib, you can do it this way. So what is interesting in that plot is that you can see that again, the high income people tend to be in the middle of this 2D plane. And more than this, you need to have a full-time job more than 40 hours a week to get a high income. So we could have a model that just looks at the number of times worked per week. And if it's less than 40 hours a week, then it's very high. There is a very large likelihood that the income is low. But for the people who work more than 40 hours per week, and it's very hard to guess. You can say that if you're too young and even if you work a lot, if you are too young, you are not likely to have a high income. But other than that, if you are in this group here, you have the two distributions that overlap by quite a bit. So it's not possible just by using those two features to make a good prediction on the income if you are in this region, basically. So we need to combine the data from the other features, the other columns to build a good model. So we won't do that by hand. This is a way to do it by hand, just by plotting stuff and making rules. But instead, we are going to use scikit-learn. I think it's good to first always to have a good look at your data using Pandas and matplotlib before trying to do machine learning black box, because if there is a weird thing in the distribution, if half of the values are zero or some constant that is meaningless, you need to use plotting tools basically to detect those artifacts. They could be data collection artifacts, or they could be something in your data collection process. There is a bug in your system, for instance, that you are not aware of. And if you don't do this kind of plot, it can be very hard to detect them. But everything looks fine in this data set. So we will extract the numerical values of this data set as an numpy array to make it possible to train a statistical machine learning model using scikit-learn. So first we need to separate the target variable from the input variables. There's this. From the input variables, so there is we can just select the income column and get a pandas series, and we can also do data.drop a specific column name with axis equal one, and that will generate a copy of the data frame without that column. The original data frame is not modified. So we have target and feature data. So out of this feature data here, here. We will extract only the columns that are of that have a numerical data type. So the data type kind should be integer or floating point number. If this is the case, we store that we store them in a specific list of features. We collect the list of features that are numerical, and then we can use these numerical features to build a numerical data frame. And just have a look at the first five rows. And so this data, we can directly feed it to scikit-learn because it's already numerical by nature. And most scikit-learn models, they will accept numerical data. If it's not scaled or not pre-processed correctly, you can get wrong results or bad results, but you won't get an exception. For the other data, the categorical data using text labels or integer labels, we need to do some kind of pre-processing. And we will do that with Pandas, because it's much easier. But there are also ways to do that using the scikit-learn API, but I think it's better for teaching to do that manually with Pandas. INF, what does it mean? So basically here, we extract the columns that have a data type. D type means data type. That has a kind, that is a subclass of integer or float, basically. I is integer and F is float. Then they could be 32-bit integer, 64-bit integer, 32-bit float, 64-bit float, or unsigned or not for integers. As long as it's one of those kind, it's numerical. Technically, I think in Pandas or at least in NumPy, there is also complex data types. We don't use them for machine learning. Yes. Yeah. 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 No. So this weighting columns means that the if you want to get the true true distribution of the full population in the US, you need to take those weights into account because some samples, some records are more representative than others. I think this is because when they do the survey, they try to investigate more in specific groups of people. Yeah. Actually, you can keep it and build the statistical models, and the kind of prediction that you get is the same. Like most of the models, they will ignore that column because they don't find it informative. Hey, Tim. but it's just that if we want to make a correct statistical inference on this data, I think we should use that variable, but then we should build a loss function to optimize our model that takes that into account, and I don't know how to do that, so... I haven't tried to do it. So we would just assume that those records are representative by themselves, uniformly sampled at random, and they are representative enough. Yes? Yeah. Yeah. So if you want to do this per column feature transformation, it really depends on the models. Some models like decision trees, for instance, they don't really care about this kind of monotonic transformation that won't affect their decision function much. But other models like linear models or neural nets, they really need standardized data. And so you need to do this kind of feature transformation. And so what you can do is, instead of doing it manually before, you can do that as transformers in a pipeline and do that later. But right now I'm just doing it manually this way so that we really understand the main categorical value transformation that we need to do. Okay, so once we have the numerical features, it's fine. What we can do is take the other features. So if we drop, we take features data again and we drop the numerical features on axis equal one. Just put axis, it's more explicit. Here, what we are left with is a new data frame with only categorical variables. And they have text labels for the categories. If we do, if we call the describe method on categorical variables, the kind of statistics that we get are slightly different than previously. And we have the count, we have the number of unique categories, and we have the most representative, most represented category for each column and the frequency, the number of times that it was observed. And so in particular, what is interesting to see here that some categories like gender, sex, is only two possible values, whereas the country of origin is like 42. So depending on the kind of pre-processing that we do, we need to be aware that some category might be overrepresented with respect to others. We can come back to that problem later. For now, we just ignore it. And because we are going to use decision trees to build the statistical model, I know that we can encode the categories as arbitrary integers, and it's going to work quite good enough. So this using this pandas.factorize operation that I wrap in a apply call to on the data, categorical data frame. Basically, I will transform this data frame into that data frame where all the string, all the string labels will be mapped to a specific integer, and then we have the integers. And then we have numerical features. Usually it's a bad numerical representation of the data for many models, like linear models, because the quantities, they don't mean anything. It's just, we just need to know that they are different. And for decision trees, it's enough. So we are going to do that. So we can reconstruct a full data frame, which we call features, which will concatenate the original numerical data and the integer coded categorical data using pd.concat. And now we have a data frame that has just numerical values, and the categories are just encoded as integers. All right. So there are different ways to encode categories, especially if you want to use support vector machine neural nets or linear models logistic regression. This integer category, categorical variable is not a good representation. And instead, what you could do is use one hot encoded categorical variable. I won't explain what it means now. But maybe at the end of the tutorial we have more time, if we have enough time. But if you want to try this, you can just uncomment those two lines and execute that instead of the previous cell. But don't do it right now, but you can do it at home if you want, and check that the rest of the notebook will still work, and actually the quality of the model is going to be approximately the same, just going to be a bit slower to execute. Okay, so now that we have the features, we can convert them to NumPy arrays of a specific data type, and we will call that X and Y, and this is the kind of data that scikit-learn models expect. So the input features, we use values, and then as type are coded as 32-bit floating point numbers, and you see that we have 32,000 records and 13 features, 13 input attributes. And the target variable is just going to be a Boolean, 0 or 1, but encoded as an integer, a 32-bit integer. It's just because scikit-learn classifiers, they expect integers because there could be more than two classes. And now, before training the first model, we will split the training set into two random subsets called the train set and the test set. And to do that, we can use the train test split function from scikit-learn. And here I pass a specific random seed, random state equals zero, so that this is a pseudo-random process, but we can get it deterministic by fixing the random seed. And this test size equal 0.2 argument here means that 80% of the records will be in the training part, and 20% of the records will be assigned to the test part. And as what we get as a result is xtrain.shape, for instance, is a NumPy array That has 80% of the records here, you can count. But it's an empire race with numerical values. And here you can see that we lost the information of the column names and so on. It's just numerical. And actually the machine learning algorithm, they don't care, just process numbers, and they just need the correct numbers. But it's just us that need the column names for interpreting what the data is about. So we will train a first decision tree classifier. So we, as I presented previously on the slides, we just import it from scikit-learn. We defined the instance of the model by calling the class constructor with a hyperparameter. In that case, we just fix one hyperparameter, which is the maximum depth of the decision tree, and we fit it. So it's very quick here because the dataset is small. But depend if you have millions of records, it can be longer. And if you fit a bunch of trees instead of a single decision tree, it can be even longer. Once we have the classification model, this is modified in place. The CLF classifier model is modified in place. And so we can call the predict method on the test data and get some predictions. So the predictions, I forgot to display maybe before, X-test. It's good to have a look at the shape of your data to as a sanity check when you're doing feature engineering like this, to make sure that you have something that makes sense. So the new records, there are 6,513 records with the same 13 columns. And we ask the model to make one prediction for each of those rows in that new data. And we don't make individual prediction one by one because it can be much faster from a computational point of view to batch the predictions into a C function or whatever. So we can have a look at the first five elements of the prediction arrays, and you can see that some of them are predicted as zero, so low income, and some of them are predicted as one, so high income. And we can compare that to the true values, X-test. So those are the true labels from the original dataset that has been split in half. And you can see that for most of them, it's making a good prediction. Like the first three, they are correct. The last one, it's also correct. But the one here, it made a mistake. So here is a small exercise. It's just using NumPy. Compare those two arrays and compute the average accuracy of the model. All right. So, how much is it? 85, I think so. So let's do it. So we can just use NumPy mean and compare the two arrays using the equality operator. 1885, yes. So actually in scikit-learn we have a function to do that, but which is called accuracy score, but it's quite easy to do it manually. So there, this is the basic metric, but for classification problems, sometimes you have an issue because the two target classes, if you have two classes, one of them is overrepresented. You have a majority class and a minority class. For instance, if you are trying to detect spam, most of the emails is going to be regular emails, but you have a small fraction that is, for instance, 1% of the email, are going to be spam. And if you have a classification model that always predict there is no spam, this classification model will have 99% accuracy. So the accuracy metric in that case is not very meaningful. So there are alternative classification metrics that that better reflect the power of classification model on imbalanced data sets. So here we will introduce a performance metric which is called area under rock curve. And ROC means receiver operator characteristic, I think, which is something from the signals literature. But it's also useful to quantify the performance of classification models. And so to compute that score, we'll need to compute predictions in a different way. Instead of calling predict, we will call predict proba. And because our classification model can be interpreted as a probabilistic model, we can get a confidence level of the model. And so, actually, for a single decision tree, it's not going to be a very good estimate of the confidence level, but at least it's not zero, it's not binary. And so here you can see that for the first five elements, it has two columns. The first column is the confidence level or probability of the output being negative, and the second column the output being positive. So if you sum the rows, they should sum to one because those could be interpreted as probabilities. So we can just consider the second column for the probability of positive predictions, and you can see that the model is very confident for the last two predictions, and it's quite confident that those are negative as well for the first one, and this one is a bit less confident. So now that we have these probabilistic predictions, we can use the ROC AUC score function from scikit-learn and compute this ROC AUC score. And it's a value between 0 and 1. And a model that predicts completely at random will have a score of 0.5 in expectation. So random models, bad models, they should be around 0.5. And perfect models that never make a mistake, they should have a 1 as a ROC score. So 0.9 is quite good. But it doesn't really mean anything. Actually, it means something, but yes, it's just you should use that to compare two different models or two different feature sets. You can use that to select the best one. So there is an issue, though, right now, is that we did a single train test split, and we computed the score on the test set. But if we tweak the model, if we change the model class, if we change the hyperparameter of the model, we might get a better score. But we don't really know whether it's going to hold in the future on new data, because by tweaking the parameters, we are basically learning, and because we are learning using the testing set, we don't know whether or not we are cheating. So it's a bad idea to do that. So instead of measuring the quality of the model when we are developing the model, we should never measure the quality of the model on the final test set. We should keep it for later. So forget that we used it now. And instead, we will use cross-validation. So cross-validation is a procedure to evaluate the quality of the model on validation set. So assume that we have a big training set like this. And when I say training set, it's actually X and Y. And those are the records, the samples. Here we have split it for a train and a test. And this test set, we will keep it for later. We ignore it. And when we do cross-validation, basically, we will use the training part of the data set, and we will split it into additional folds, like for instance 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And we will build new training set out of that by recombining 1, 3, 4, 5, for instance. We just don't use that. And the fold number 2 here will be kept separated as a new validation set. Okay? And then we can do the same with 1. Actually, I forgot to do 1. I will do it first here. We can use the fold number 1 as the validation set. And then we just ignore that. And 2, 3, 4, 5. And this is a new training set. And we do that several times, five times. And for each of those reconfiguration of the data, we will train a new model, for instance, CLF1 here, classifier 1, classifier 2, classifier 3, and until 5. So we'll train 5 classification models, and we will compute the accuracy metric or the rock AUC metric 5 times. So it could be, for instance, 0.85 here, 0.86. Because there is some randomness in the way we reshuffle the samples, it's going to be slightly different each time. And then the final cross-validation score is going to be the average of those 5 score. And it's going to represent the ability of our model to generalize on this data set without looking at the final test set. And at the end of the procedure, when we have found the best model that has the best cross-validation score, we can actually compute the true test accuracy and compare that to the cross-validation accuracy and see whether or not they match. They should match. If they don't match, it means that we made a mistake somewhere in our code. It's a methodological mistake that can be detected this way. So to do this full procedure in scikit-learn, we can just use cross-val score. we just give that function the classification model that we want to evaluate, the full training set, the number of cross-validation folds that we want to use, could be 3, 5, 10. Usually between 5 and 20 is fine. If you do k-fold cross-validation, use 5 or 10. If you use 10, it's going to be twice as slower than if you use 5, but then you get slightly more stable estimate. And we also give the name of the accuracy metric that we want to use, or the performance metric that we want to use. In this case, it's rock AUC. And so if I execute this, I get the scores of the individual folds. 0.9, 0.89, and so on. And I can also compute the average score across the cross-validation folds and the standard deviation to get some confidence level in our estimate. So here you can see that it's around this value and it's fluctuating on this scale, basically. So if you compare two different models, and you see that there are cross-validation score difference is on the scale of the standard deviation of the scores across fold, then it means that they are basically performing the same, and you should consider them the same, basically. Do you have questions? Yes. Okay. Yeah. 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 So it's a very good question. By default, the k-fold cross-validation model tool that is used by this function does not randomize to get a deterministic output. But if you want to randomize, you can, instead of passing an integer here, you can pass a CV object. And if you Google cross-validation, I think just if you Google cross-validation alone, you should find the scikit-learn documentation. No. you will find the documentation with all the cross-validation strategies. There are many of them. So k-fold cross-validation that I've presented here is the most traditional way to do it. But there are many of them. So where are they? Yeah, the cross-validation iterators. So they, many of them, they make the assumption that the data is independent and identically distributed, which means that if you shuffle, that should not change the outcome. If it's not the case, and you want to generalize Actually, you can use the fact that you shuffle and not, and if you get a different result, it's a good clue that your data is not IID. And then you should identify the group structure, the groups of samples, and use that to build a cross-validation scheme that take that into account. And if you want to do a group-based cross-validation, you can use a cross-validation iterators for group data, and you have group k-fold and leave one group out and stuff like that. For instance, if you record several stuff on a specific subject, and you have 10 subjects and 10 records per subject, and you build a model that predicts stuff on people, you want to generalize across people. So you should keep a test set of a specific person that has never been seen in the training set. So you can treat a subject ID as a group ID. Or you could use, if you have several record devices, like a scanner, for instance, and you should make, for instance, use recorded with a specific scanner in the test set and train with on data that from different scanners, so that you can measure the ability of the model to generalize across recording device, and you're actually not memorizing specific artifact of individual scanners. Okay. So I think we should stop now. Maybe just a question, but then there is the break. Yes. Yes. So the question is, can I pass anything that has a fit and a predict here to CrossVal score? Yes, and if you don't provide the scoring function here, I think you should also implement the score method, and it will use the default score method of this object. But if you want to build your own estimators, it's a good idea to have a look at the scikit-learn documentation where we document the protocol or the API of the estimator. And there is also a base estimator class that you can use to derive, but it should work even though if you don't derive from that class. But I'm not sure, 100% sure, but it should work in many cases. We make as few assumptions as possible. Okay, so I think we should break now because the coffee is warm, and then come back in, I think it's 15 minutes or something. Okay, see you soon.